Now let us move into chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, beginning with the first verse. He that is wounded in the stones, or hath his privy member cut off, shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. This is a directive concerning eunuchs, and the prohibition here is that they shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. The same thing is said about bastards and the Ammonites and the Moabites. But there's a big question as to exactly what is meant by entering into the congregation of the Lord. Some think that this prohibited them from being able to communicate with the Israelites in certain of the religious services. Others think that they are hereby excluded from bearing office in the congregation. That is, none of these could be elders or judges, lest the honor of the nation should be thereby stained. And others think that it simply excludes them from marrying with Israelites. But it is not an easy solution to know the total meaning of this phrase, shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. However, we do know that there was some kind of a prohibition here placed upon those that would be classified as eunuchs, or those that would be wounded in the testicles or genitalia. We do know that eunuchs were admitted as members of the church. However, there was some kind of a mark placed upon them because of this fact that they did have a dismemberment of the genitalia. Verse 2, a similar thing is said about a bastard. A bastard shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even to his tenth generation shall he not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Now this phrase of tenth generation really implies that he would be banned from entering into the congregation of the Lord forever. There would just be no actual limit on how long it would take for him to overcome this prohibition. But an interesting thing here is as to exactly what is meant by the word bastard. We think commonly of a bastard being somebody who is born out of wedlock. However, that cannot be the proper meaning as it's used in this place. In all probability, the meaning here has to do with those children that were born of incestuous relationships like those mentioned in Leviticus, the 18th chapter. Because we have ample evidence that a person simply being born out of wedlock was not banned from being entered into the congregation or to serve in a high office. And the case I'd like to turn to show that, is the case of Jephthah found in Judges, the 11th chapter. Let's read a few verses from Judges 11, beginning with the first verse. Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a mighty man of valor, and he was the son of an harlot. And Gilead begat Jephthah. And Gilead's wife bare him sons, and his wife's sons grew up, and they thrust out Jephthah, and said unto him, Thou shalt not inherit in our father's house, for thou art the son of a strange woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brethren, and dwelt in the land of Tob, and there were gathered vain men to Jephthah, and went out with him. And it came to pass in process of time that the children of Ammon made war against Israel. And it was so that when the children of Ammon made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to fetch Jephthah out of the land of Tob. And they said unto Jephthah, Come, and be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, Did you not hate me, and expel me out of my father's house? Why are you come unto me now, when you are in distress? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, Therefore we turn again to thee now, that thou mayest go with us and fight against the children of Ammon, and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And Jephthah said unto the elders of Gilead, If you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Lord deliver them from before me, shall I be your head? And the elders of Gilead said unto Jephthah, The Lord be witness between us, if we do not so according to thy words. And Jephthah went out with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and captain over them. And Jephthah uttered all his word before the Lord in Mizpah. And again we read in Judges the 12th chapter, verse 7, And Jephthah judged Israel 6 years. Then died Jephthah the Gileadite and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. So there's no question about the fact that this man was born out of wedlock. He was the son of a harlot. And later on, his half-brothers actually expelled him from the household because he had a harlot for a mother, and he was not to have an inheritance with them. But then later, he became a judge over Israel, and he was a judge for 6 years. Again, we find in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, this same man, Jephthah, is spoken of as being a man who had faith. In Hebrews 11, beginning with the 32nd verse, "And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and of Barak, and of Samson, and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel, and of the prophets." Now notice, he's listed in the same verse with men like Samson, Barak, and David, and Samuel, and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn asunder, were tempted, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskin and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. The point I want to make here is that he names Jephthah with these great characters, and he says that these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. So here was a man who was definitely born out of wedlock. His mother was a harlot, yet he rose to the heights of being a judge over Israel for 6 years. He was their leader, he was their captain, and consequently, the book of Hebrews speaks of him in the most high words, placing him in the same category with the other greats like Samuel and David, and declaring him to be a man of faith. So we know then this verse does not include that situation. This verse includes a situation, no doubt, as we mentioned earlier, of those incestuous relationships in which those persons were not allowed then to enter into the congregation because they would then taint the heritage of God's people. Verse 3, "An Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even to their 10th generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever." As we said earlier, this idea of the 10th generation pretty well included all of the foreseeable offspring, "because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam the son of Beor of Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse thee." So he gives two reasons why these nations of Ammonites, of the Ammonites and the Moabites, shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. One reason is because as they were, the children of Israel were coming out of the wilderness area, getting ready to make their approach to enter into the land of Canaan toward the end of their 40 years of wandering. These nations would not meet them with bread and water in the way and give them any help along their journey. And this is a failure to help a fellow human being in a time of need with the most simple of needs, bread and water. And we're even told by Jesus that on the judgment day we're going to be asked about and judged according to whether or not we did actually provide such simple things as bread and water for those that are hungry and thirsty. These things that seem small with us are certainly not small in the eyes of God. So that's one of the reasons why they could never enter into the congregation of the Lord. Another reason was because they hired Balaam to curse the people. And Balaam wanted to do it and he tried to do it. But as he mentions here in verse 5, "Nevertheless, the Lord thy God would not hearken unto Balaam, but the Lord thy God turned the curse into a blessing unto thee, because the Lord thy God loved thee." Now, Balaam did try to curse the people, but actually, through God, his prophecies turned out to be correct prophecies. God caused him to prophesy the correct things. And his prophecies then became a remarkable prediction of Israel's influential place in history through a star to arise out of Jacob. And, of course, the account of this is found Numbers chapters 22 through 25. The Ammonites and the Moabites were the descendants of Lot. And as we remember from Genesis 13:11, Lot separated himself from Abraham, and we do not find that he or his ever again joined themselves to the children of the covenant. So it says furthermore in verse 6, "Thou shalt not seek their peace, nor their prosperity, all thy days forever." So these two nations had been just completely banned from having a relationship that would be a profitable relationship with the children of Israel. Verse 7, "Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. Thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, because thou wast a stranger in his land." Now this seems rather strange to us as we look at it on the surface. The Edomites were the descendants of Esau, and they were the bitter enemies of the Jews. And also the Egyptians had been the ones who had held them in captivity and abused and misused them for some 400 years. And yet we see that they could have a closer relationship with the people of God than could the Ammonites and the Moabites, who were really closer kin. And so he simply says, "Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother." An Edomite could actually become a member of the congregation. "And thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, because thou wast a stranger in his land." They lived in the land of the Egyptians. And actually, when you look at it from one standpoint, it was the Egyptians who took them in during the time of the famine, and they did allow them to prosper and progress to the point that they were allowed to come out of there being a mighty nation with the help of God. He says in verse 8, "The children that are begotten of them shall enter into the congregation of the Lord in their third generation." So an Edomite or an Egyptian could have their grandchildren to actually enter into the congregation of the Lord. And so the stigma was only through the third generation on them, and they could really see an end to it in their posterity. As we think about this passage, we'd like to make a special note of the fact that these prohibitions were only to apply during the time of the law of Moses, and they were done away with after Christ came and established the church, and they do not apply under the Christian age. We have a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 56 that states this in such a way that gives us much assurance along that line. In Isaiah 56, beginning with the second verse, he says, "Blessed is the man that doeth this, and the son of man that layeth hold on it, that keepeth the Sabbath from polluting it, and keepeth his hand from doing any evil. Neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, The Lord hath utterly separated me from his people. Neither let the eunuch say, Behold, I am a dry tree." So this prophecy is saying that in the future time, and the time when the Lord is going to extend his blessings to all mankind, which is really talking about the Christian age, the son of the stranger, which is the foreigner, that hath joined himself unto the Lord, had no right to speak, saying, The Lord hath utterly separated me from his people. Neither would the eunuch have the right to say, Behold, I am a dry tree. That is, I am not able to bring forth fruit for the Lord. So the stranger, nor this eunuch, in this future time, would not be classified as one who could not actually come into the congregation of the Lord. And he goes on and says more about this in Isaiah 56, "For thus saith the Lord unto the eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, and choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant." Now there are three things here that he names. These are eunuchs that keep my Sabbaths, they choose the things that please me, and take hold of my covenant. These are also people that have joined themselves unto the Lord. So in verse 5 he says, "Even unto them will I give in mine house, and within my walls a place, and a name better than of sons and of daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off." So this passage teaches quite plainly that these limitations placed on the eunuchs and the bastards and the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Edomites and Egyptians would not be a binding prohibition during the Christian age. Beginning with the 9th verse of Deuteronomy 23, we have a section that deals with their abstaining from various types of pollution. In the 9th verse, "When the host goeth forth against thine enemies, then keep thee from every wicked thing." Now this is talking about the army. When the army goes forth against the enemies, that is, it is prepared and ready and engaging in battle with the enemy, then he says, "Keep thee from every wicked thing." Now this is talking about moral or spiritual pollution. Do not engage in any kind of a wicked thing that could corrupt you, any kind of a thing that would cause you to be spiritually unacceptable in the sight of God. Every wicked thing. Moral or spiritual pollution. The next verse, "If there be among you any man that is not clean by reason of uncleanness that chanceth him by night, then shall he go abroad out of the camp, he shall not come within the camp. But it shall be when evening cometh on, he shall wash himself with water, and when the sun is down, he shall come into the camp again." Now this is talking about some kind of ceremonial pollution. Some way this person had become unclean. It doesn't specify what the way is, whether he had come in contact with someone who was sick, with a disease that would cause those who had contacted him to be unclean, or whether he had touched a dead body, or just what the cause is. But when this did happen, when he got into a position of being not clean by reason of uncleanness that chanceth him by night, then he was to, when evening cometh on, to wash himself with water, and when the sun is down, he'll come into the camp again. He had to be treated as though one were unclean and separated from the camp until he had removed that ceremonial uncleanness. Next we have, beginning in the 12th verse, talking about natural pollution, some kind of a natural uncleanness or natural pollution. He says, verse 12, "Thou shalt have a place also without the camp, whither thou shalt go forth abroad. And thou shalt have a paddle upon thy weapon, and it shall be, when thou wilt ease thyself abroad, that thou shalt dig therewith, and shalt turn back and cover that which cometh from thee." Now he's talking about natural cleanliness here, a way to prevent the spread of disease and the elimination of filthiness that could occur around a camp of soldiers. And he explains how this is to be done. They're to have a place without the camp, and there's where they go to take care of their toilet habits. And he even describes the fact that they are to have a paddle, that they dig a place where the excrement is deposited, and then they cover it back over again. And he explains in verse 14, "For the Lord thy God walketh in the midst of thy camp to deliver thee, and to give up thine enemies before thee. Therefore shall thy camp be holy, that he see no unclean thing in thee, and turn away from thee." Now we have, as we said before, three types of uncleanness or pollution here. One is moral or spiritual pollution, one is ceremonial pollution, and then thirdly, the natural pollution. Now the Lord walked in their camp. He was a part of their army. He was going to deliver them from their enemies. He was going to give up the enemies before them. Therefore, since the Lord was going to be there, Lord would be present there, then the camp would be a holy place. And he was not to see any unclean thing there, and that would make him then to be offended or to turn away from them. We today, as we embark on our various activities, should certainly keep in mind the fact that we expect the Lord to walk in our camp. We expect the Lord to be with us and to deliver us and to give us the victory. And consequently, we should be very cautious not to allow anything to be in our camp that would be offensive to the Lord, that would cause the Lord to turn away from us, that cause the Lord to leave our camp because we're engaged in some kind of activity that the Lord does not like and that the Lord will not remain in the presence of. So the lesson, although it was a very literal thing for them, the lesson also applies to us in a spiritual sense today, in that we too should be cognizant of the presence of the Lord and not allow other things to be present that would be offensive to the Lord. Verse 15, Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. He shall dwell with thee, even among you, in that place which he shall choose in one of thy gates, where it liketh him best. Thou shalt not oppress him. This passage probably does not refer to any servant that would run away from any master. In all likelihood, it's talking about a servant that would run away from a master in one of the surrounding nations. Consequently, this would be a servant that had escaped from a master that was one of the enemies of Israel. Now, we can also possibly assume that if this servant escaped from his master, that the master was abusing or mistreating him to the point that the servant no longer wished to dwell in the service of this master. But it seems to me that if this servant escaped from one of the nations round about, a nation which was actually an enemy to Israel, that in order for Israel then to not do anything to help their enemies, which would build up their power against them, then they could take these runaway servants and give them refuge. And this also is probably a way that God had of showing mercy to the depressed and oppressed people. And it's also a way that Israel could stand to gain some sincere, faithful, diligent proselytes. Thou shalt not deliver unto his master the servant which is escaped from his master unto thee. Now, they were not to send this servant back to his master. And when we stop and think about it, Israel was not trying to help these people anyway that lived around about them. They were not trying to build up the strength of their enemies because they were to have to overcome these enemies. He shall dwell with thee, even among you, in that place which he shall choose in one of thy gates, where it liketh him best. So this servant then would have the opportunity to choose the place where he wanted to dwell. He was to dwell among them. He was not to be segregated. He was not to be put in a place that was of lesser desirability. But he was to choose a place that he liked, the place that he liked best. And it says, Thou shalt not oppress him. Consequently, he was not to be abused or mistreated. He was not to be treated as though he were still a slave or a servant, but he was to be treated in such a way that it could not be counted as any kind of abuse or any kind of oppression. So this is an interesting feature now of the character that Israel was to have. Those servants that had escaped from their masters were to be given refuge and were to be treated in such a way that they could live where they chose to live and they would not be oppressed. Verse 17, There shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor a sodomite of the sons of Israel. Thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore, or the price of a dog, into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow. For even both these are abomination unto the Lord thy God. This passage is definite, plain instruction about the feeling that God had about this great sin of fornication and adultery, and the sin of sodomy or homosexuality. He says, There shall be no whore of the daughters of Israel, nor sodomite of the sons of Israel. This was a sin that he did not want to be named among his people, and anyone guilty of these sins were not allowed to continue to exist. This was not a thing taken lightly. It was not a thing that could be overlooked by society. It was to be dealt with. It was to be not tolerated. Now, he further says, Thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog. Now, the hire of a whore would be the money that a whore made by practicing her profession, and the hire of a dog, or the price of a dog, is probably the money that was made by the sodomite, or a pimp, or a whoremaster. Now, some may think this price of a dog is referring to the actual selling of a dog, but the Bible does refer to this type of person as a dog. For example, in Revelation 22:15, blessed are they that do his commandments, and they that have right to the tree of life, and may enter in through the gates into the city. For without are dogs, and sorcerers, and whoremongers, and murderers, and idolaters, and whosoever loveth and maketh a lie. So he's classifying these grievous sins in such a way that they are called dogs. And the context here would demand that the word dog be used in the same way. And consistency would also demand that whatever applies to the money or the price that a whore would make would also apply to the price of those who perpetuate and practice along with this person this business of fornication and adultery. It says, thou shalt not bring the hire of a whore or the price of a dog into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow. That is, the money that they made doing these evil deeds could not be used to buy or pay for a vow. They could not take this money and pay it to God in order to pay their way out of their sin, or in order to pay anything that they owed to God. God would not have this money to be used in his cause. He refused to receive this money. And as you know, there are some persons that do the most vile and wicked acts, and yet they take the profit they make out of doing these acts, and they pay it to a church or to a religious organization, and they, by virtue of the great amount of money they have, they then are able to buy righteousness in the sight of those people with whom they have to deal. This is a practice that is not tolerated by God. God would not recognize this money as being any kind of payment towards rectifying or justifying the people who did these deeds. And he says the money is not to be brought into the house of the Lord thy God for any vow. These people could not use that money to make a vow with, could not use that money to make themselves right with God. And that seems to be only right, of course, because the person who remains honest and maybe has less money because of it should not be able to be put in a position in which he would seem to be less righteous because he had less money than the person who made more money in a dishonest means. And he further says, for even both these are abomination unto the Lord thy God. And it tells us one thing for sure, that the money that we get and use in God's work must be money that is gotten by legitimate, open and above board, acceptable means. We cannot get money by an unacceptable means and assume then that we can take this and use it for God's work and that God is going to be well pleased with us. I know that this thing has been done multitudes of times by the digressive groups, but it is money that God would not have in his house. So consequently, when we make our money, we need to be double sure that the money we make is made in a proper way, it is made in a business that is an acceptable business to God, and not in a way in which we have either used sinful means or we have defrauded someone to get the gain. Beginning in verse 19, he discusses the matter of usury. Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of victuals, usury of anything that is lent upon usury. Now, as you know, one of the great customs that's associated with lending money money that's being borrowed to use for some other purpose, there is a price extracted. It's called interest. Here it's called usury. Well, when they were loaning to a brother, whether it be money, victuals, or anything that's lent, they were not to lend it upon usury. That is, they were not to extract the interest. They were not to charge interest for it. Now, verse 20 says, "Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury." Now, if we stop and think about this, the situation of these people was that God had and was intending to give them this land of Canaan, and he was going to divide the land among the tribes and among the families so that each tribe and each family would receive a proportionate part of the land. And when they started out, then everything would be fairly well evenly distributed. And every 50 years, the land went back to the original owner in the year of Jubilee. So there was no way for a small group to obtain large holdings or large possessions and keep them for very long, because this year of Jubilee would then redistribute the land back to the groups that originally owned the land. So there wasn't a whole lot of borrowing to take place for the purpose of making a big profit. Probably most of the borrowing that was done from brother to brother was a small amount, and it was to get by hard times and for the immediate necessities. So since God had so distributed the wealth of the land that it was to continue to stay fairly well evenly distributed among the people, there was not this necessary need then to charge usury or interest for the money that was loaned. And it seems that when a brother was in need, to charge him interest then for borrowing what he needed was simply a means of further oppressing him. Now, we know that usury of itself is not oppression and is not sin. And it wasn't so then, because he says, "Unto a stranger thou mayest lend upon usury." And of course, they were not to oppress a stranger, so usury wasn't oppression. But the stranger more than likely could have been a person who was borrowing for the purpose of making a profit out of the use of this money. He was more commercialized in his borrowing, and consequently, they could lend upon usury. They could charge usury. "But unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury." And the reason for this, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all that thou settest thine hand to do in the land, whether thou goest to possess it. So this was one of the ways in that the Lord would continue to bless them if they would not oppress each other with usury in the lending they did among themselves, and consequently they would loan freely and only expect to get back what they actually had loaned. Now, you remember back in the 15th chapter of Deuteronomy, the law was stated very plainly that every seventh year, the creditor that had lent money to his neighbor was to release it. And he was not to exact it of his neighbor or of his brother, because it was called the Lord's release. So that there was a built-in method here whereby the poor that really could not pay were allowed to have their debts forgiven them every 7 years. So the laws about lending were quite different from what we're used to in Gentile commercial surroundings. But God didn't intend for one person to oppress or to make a profit at the expense of another person's misfortune. They were to live together in peace and harmony, and they were to have a relative amount of common wealth. However, one could become more wealthy than another, but in the long run, the wealth tended to go back to the original owners. Beginning in verse 21, he talks about the vows that were made and their obligation to pay these vows. "When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it. For the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. Now, as I understand it, a vow here was something that was beyond the requirements of the law. If a person decided he wanted to make an offering or a sacrifice that was beyond what the law actually required that he do, and he's able to do this, then he makes the vow that he will do it, and then he cannot be slack to pay it. He has to go through with the act. He cannot decide later that he is not going to do it because it wasn't really required in the first place. Once he makes the vow, he must go through with it. Now in verse 22, "But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee." Now they had the right to not make a vow of this nature if they didn't want to. If they weren't able to pay extra, they didn't have to do it. If they didn't want to, they didn't have to. But if they promised to do it, then they must do it. And this was a free will offering. It was not something that the law required unless they vowed that they would do it. And I think one of the things here is that it kept the priest from being put into a position to require extra offerings, sacrifices that the law did not require simply under the name of a vow. A vow was something that was a free will offering. And if they didn't want to do it, if they would forbear to vow, then it shall be no sin in thee. Verse 23, "That which is gone out of thy lips, thou shalt keep and perform." Now, if they had made the vow, if they made the promise, if they said they were going to give it, then they were duty-bound to do it. Even a free will offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth. So once they made the promise that they were going to give it, there was no backing out, there was no changing of it. They were duty-bound by the law to follow through with their vows. Much of this same principle applies to us today in the New Testament church as we contribute of our means and lay by in store upon the first day of the week. The Apostle Paul, in talking about this in 2 Corinthians 9, beginning with the 6th verse, says, "But I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." So our contributions today are made like the vows were, in that they are made cheerfully and not grudgingly and not of necessity.